Macro Voices Accredited Investor Academy is a special four-part series featuring hedge fund manager Eric Townsend. This program is intended primarily for high net worth individuals and other accredited investors, but may be of interest to retail investors who seek to understand the world of private equity, hedge funds, and other alternative investments available only to accredited investors under U.S. law. This special four-part series for accredited investors is offered in conjunction with the free Macro Voices weekly podcast program, which specifically targets professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. More information about the free Macro Voices podcast can be found at macrovoices.com. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Aaron Chan.
Hi, I'm Eric Townsend. Welcome to part four of our Accredited Investor Academy series. Before going any farther, I need to explain that we changed the format slightly from what was announced in parts one and two. Originally, we conceived parts three and four as standalone chapters, with part three focusing on private equity and part four focusing on hedge funds. But what we realized after parts one and two were already recorded is that all of these alternative investment vehicles share in common the same legal structures based on limited partnership interests, and they also share in common similar fee structures, which are essential for investors to understand. So here's the bottom line. Part 3 has effectively become a prerequisite to this Part 4. We covered alternative investment legal structures and compensation models in Part 3, and that material is essential to understanding what we're going to cover in this part. So contrary to what I said when we first laid out the table of contents in Part 1, you really do need to listen to Part 3 first before this Part 4 will make sense. The other change we've made is to add coverage of managed commodity futures funds as well as commodity trading advisors to this episode, Part 4.
And I'm Aaron Chan, your co-host for the series. Eric, with that disclaimer out of the way, let's dive straight into hedge funds. I think the phrase hedge fund is fascinating unto itself because at least 95% of the general population has heard that term, but less than 1% actually understand what it means. Now, the general public are mostly convinced that hedge fund is a secret code word for some evil Republican-dominated enterprise designed to undermine society and promote wealth inequality. So let's start from the beginning. Where did this phrase hedge fund come from, and what does it mean?
Well, let's set the Wayback Machine to 1949, when a fellow named Alfred Winslow Jones came to Wall Street and invented something that evolved into the modern hedge fund. In those days, it was common for men on Wall Street to go by their first two initials and their last name, as with J.P. Morgan and E.F. Hutton. So he was known as A.W. Jones to most. And like myself, Jones was an entrepreneur who had done other things in life before coming to finance. So when Jones arrived on Wall Street, he wasn't just another kid fresh out of school trying to imitate the actions of those who preceded him. Instead, he took a fresh look at how the business of money management was being done on Wall Street, and he quickly concluded that the status quo didn't make much sense to him. They had the equivalent of actively managed mutual funds back in those days. The legal structure was slightly different, and they were called unit trusts, but conceptually, they were the same thing as what we think of today as an actively managed mutual fund. Jones observed that the whole money management business, as it was practiced in those days, didn't make a whole lot of sense. All the unit trust managers were running around touting their investment returns, trying to woo investors into their funds. But Jones was quick to see that the lion's share of investment returns were coming from whether the market on whole was up or down in a given year. The guy who was running around screaming at the top of his lungs about how his fund was up 22% on the year generally failed to mention that the Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 23% in the same year, thus implying that that manager's management talent had actually resulted in a 1% underperformance compared to the benchmark index.
Okay, so for those of us who were forced to study modern portfolio theory in school, Jones was basically saying that investment returns are mostly about beta, meaning the return that comes just from being in the stock market, and that the unit trust managers weren't really delivering much in terms of alpha, which is the portion of the return attributable to the manager outperforming the benchmark index relevant to his fund.
Precisely. So what Jones proceeded to do was effectively turn the industry upside down by pioneering two key innovations. The first innovation Jones pioneered was to design a portfolio that consisted of approximately equal numbers of long and short positions. So, in other words, all of the other guys were long only, meaning they were just trying to pick the very best stocks they could find and go long those stocks. Jones recognized that this would always result in performance that was much more about the market than the manager. So Jones' approach was to pick both the best stocks and the worst stocks that he could find, and then go long the best stocks and short the worst stocks. If the market was up on the year, Jones would probably lose money on his short book, but he'd make more money on his long book. On the other hand, if the market was down on the year, meaning that all the other guys were losing money, Jones would probably make more on his short book than he lost on his long book. Jones' innovative strategy enabled something that's since become known as absolute returns, or pure alpha. That is, being able to produce a positive return in both up and down years in the stock market. And when you stop and really think about that, the strategy Jones devised for having equal numbers of long and short positions also makes it safer to use leverage. In a long-only portfolio, leverage magnifies profits, but it also magnifies losses. In a long-short portfolio, the leverage on the long side is offset by leverage on the short side. So you can engineer a portfolio that benefits from leverage without blowing up when the market has a down year. The second innovation Jones pioneered was that he wanted to be compensated by being cut in on a share of the profits as opposed to just being paid a small percentage of the total account size that he was managing.
That's amazing. So what you're saying is that Jones basically invented a way to hedge market risk in the long position of his portfolio by having an equally sized short portfolio. Now, going back to modern portfolio theory terminology, he was essentially hedging out market risk by being exposed to both long and short positions, brilliantly isolating alpha, the portion of the return attributable to the manager's stock-picking skills, while completely hedging out beta, which is the part of the investment returns nobody can predict, because some years the market goes up and other years it just goes down. So, Eric, based on what you've described, I see how Jones was able to engineer a pure alpha portfolio, one that produces a positive return in both up and down years for the stock market. Now, that's absolutely brilliant. So he called this a hedge fund because it ingeniously hedged out beta risk and thus made it possible to safely lever up a strategy that would deliver a positive alpha-derived return every year, regardless of whether the market was up or down.
You got it. Exactly right.
Okay, now, this makes more sense to me. So the reason that 65 years later, we still call these things hedge funds is that they must all follow Jones's brilliant design of a portfolio that hedges market risk using both long and short sub-portfolios, leading to an absolute return based almost entirely on the alpha enabled by the manager's stock-picking skills on both the long and short sides of the portfolio.
Hold on, not so fast. I told you that Jones pioneered two inventions back in 1949. The first is exactly what you just described extremely well, hedging out market risk with a short sub-portfolio, thereby allowing the fund to produce a positive return even in down years for the stock market. And that was a huge benefit for investors in his fund. But Jones' second innovation was not to benefit the investor. It was to benefit Jones, the manager, by taking a cut of the profits rather than the conventional management fee that other managers were charging based on the overall account size. Now, Aaron, you've been working on Wall Street for a few years now, and you've been exposed to the culture. So which of these two innovations, the one for the manager or the one for the investor, do you think the fine, upstanding community of Wall Street professionals embraced most aggressively?
Well, let me venture a guess. Instead of focusing mainly on strategy, they had their sights set on the idea of lining their own pockets by getting paid a cut of the winnings, and in the process, actually co-opted the phrase hedge fund that Jones had coined because it had gotten traction with investors. And then they likely started inventing strategies of likely dubious value that might not have actually hedged anything at all, but which fully embraced Jones's concept of getting paid a share of the profits, thereby satisfying their own needs. Final answer.
Bingo. The definition of a modern hedge fund, effectively, is it is a fund that is available only to accredited investors, and the manager is rewarded for his efforts with a share of the profits that are made from everyone's investment. The manager would like you to believe that he's doing something clever or special enough to justify paying him much more than other managers of mutual funds by giving him a cut of the winnings, rather than just a mutual fund-style small percentage of the account. account size. But it's not always true that he's earning it. The strategy that Jones pioneered is definitely still in use today, and it's become known as long-short equity. But that's just one of dozens of different so-called hedge fund strategies. Some of them actually hedge risk, as is the case with the long-short equity strategy. Others don't hedge anything, but because they have fee structures that cut the manager in on a share of the profits, they're still known as hedge funds. The fact the manager is getting a share of the profits makes it illegal to sell these investment vehicles to the general public. So they're only available to accredited investors under the 3C1 or 3C7 exemptions that we discussed in part 3 of this series. Some of them are absolutely brilliant, innovative strategies that deliver outsized returns on a consistent and reliable basis. Others are just long-only mutual funds managed by con men who want to get in on a share of the winnings in up years and let the investors take a beating in down years.
All right, so the bottom line is that hedge funds are designed with the ultimate goal of outperforming the market. The managers want to be cut in on the profits they deliver, and because of regulatory requirements, that means they can only be offered to accredited investors. Now, some of these funds follow the long-short equity strategy, pioneered by A.W. Jones, but many other strategies exist and have since been developed as well. In terms of the characteristics of the investment returns, there are obviously different ways of trying to beat the market. Eric, can you speak to these different types of returns and who they might appeal to?
In the case of hedge funds that are designed to appeal to high net worth individuals and family offices, it's all about beating the market by delivering outsized returns, bigger returns on an annual basis than you'd expect from public market investments. But a recent trend in the industry is that funds that are designed to appeal to institutional investors tend to focus more on modest returns in the high single digits, but with extremely low volatility. They care more about volatility than they care about returns. And the reason is that institutional investors need a replacement for bonds in conservative portfolios. Back in the day, they could get a 5% risk-free return on treasury bonds. Those days are long gone. So they need a low-volatility replacement for bonds that consistently produces a modest return with extremely low risk. And that's probably the biggest growth area in the hedge fund industry right now. Now, this trend creates an interesting anomaly. Critics of hedge funds will tell you that, hey, the investment returns produced by hedge funds overall, on average, are really not all that high. And they're correct about that. But what they fail to notice is that most of the modern hedge fund industry are funds that are designed not to produce outsized returns, but to produce exceptionally low volatility. So it should come as no surprise. They are, in fact, outperforming the market, but they're outperforming the market in the form of extremely low volatility rather than in the form of outsized returns. And most people fail to appreciate that distinction.
Okay, now I want to go back to all those studies on active management. You know, the business about running both a long and short book to hedge market risk and make it much safer to employ leverage all makes perfect sense to me now. But in the time I've spent learning about hedge funds and markets, it seems there are natural impediments to how you can trade, what securities you can reasonably speculate in, and how well you can perform depending on the size of your fund. So, Eric, can you speak to the finer nuances of potential hedge fund performance?
The first concept to understand is that it's extremely difficult to beat the market when you're trading in size. And in industry parlance, that means running billions and billions of dollars under management in something like an active managed mutual fund. A lot of the most innovative and profitable hedge fund strategies are capacity limited, meaning that a talented manager really and truly can produce outsized returns that beat the market when they're running, let's say, $100 million in assets under management. But that same guy could never beat the market if he was running $10 billion in assets. The reason is that a lot of hedge fund strategies have to do with finding small anomalies where something is mispriced. The big boys that are running tens of billions in a big mutual fund like, say, Fidelity Magellan, they can't look for mispriced assets because their own trading would move the price of the underlying asset by so much that that mispricing anomaly would be completely obliterated. It's for this exact reason that Ray Dalio at Bridgewater Capital is a living legend in the hedge fund industry. Over the last 20 years, Ray Dalio portfolio has produced an average 18% annual return and only 3 down years out of 20. Now, that sounds pretty good, but, you know, frankly, in the hedge fund world, those numbers aren't really all that impressive unto themselves. There are other managers that are doing well above 20% a year. He's only doing 18%. But the thing is, Ray Dalio is delivering those returns with $170 billion, with a B, dollars of assets under management. The reason he's a living legend in the industry is that it's unheard of to produce outsized returns on that large of an asset base. So making 18% a year for 20 years straight may not be a big deal in the hedge fund world, but on that size, you know, upwards of $100 billion, that is utterly astonishing.
Okay, so is the benefit of smaller fund size the primary reason that some hedge fund managers dramatically outperform the indices year after year?
Well, that's definitely one important reason. But frankly, the main reason that all those actively managed mutual funds and ETFs seldom outperform the index funds is that no truly talented active asset manager in his right mind is going to want to work as a mutual fund manager if he has what it takes to consistently outperform the market. The guys who have the talent to outperform the market have a choice. They can be active mutual fund managers and get paid like one, or they can go launch their own hedge fund and make 10 times as much. It should come as no surprise that the really talented managers all want to run hedge funds rather than ETFs or mutual funds.
So you said that there are several reasons. What are some of these other reasons?
Most hedge fund strategies couldn't be delivered in an ETF or a mutual fund because they rely on short selling, leverage, and other sophisticated techniques. Mutual funds and ETFs sold to the public generally can't trade exotic instruments, use leverage, and do all of the things needed to implement a typical hedge fund strategy because regulations limit their investments.
I want to talk about what some of those other strategies you refer to are and how they work later in this conversation. But Eric, since you said that there are plenty of examples of hedge fund managers consistently beating the index funds, how about citing some examples for us?
Well, I'll give you several examples. In the heyday of their quantum fund, Jim Rogers and George Soros famously delivered 4,200% returns to investors over a 7-year period. But what's really striking is that was during the 1970s, one of the worst decades ever for the stock market. So that's just one example of a hedge fund delivering more than 4,000%. They turned a $100,000 initial investment into $4.2 million. In less than a decade, when almost everybody else was getting crushed in the markets. Another example, Stan Druckenmiller's Duquesne Fund delivered average annual returns north of 30% for something like 15 years straight. Another name that most people have never even heard of is Jim Simons. Jim Simons' company, Renaissance Technologies on Long Island, was the original computerized quant hedge fund. We're not talking about high-frequency trading here. That's something completely different. What we're talking about is taking the time-tested practice of analyzing balance sheets and income statements in order to find the very strongest companies to invest in and automating that process with computers. So Simons' flagship product, called Medallion Fund, returned a 71.8% average gross return for the 20-year period from 1994 to 2014. So step back and think about that for a minute. 20 years in a row, 71.8% average annual return. So beating the market is clearly possible. Results like that, you can't just chalk it up to, you know, random chance or the guy got lucky or something like that. A true statement, however, is that relatively few people are able to achieve those kinds of returns, and they can't do it with huge asset bases in the hundreds of billions because their strategies are capacity limited. The other thing to understand is that if they can really do it consistently, there's no way they're going to settle for less than a cut of the profits. So for that reason, all the guys who truly have market-beating skills run hedge funds rather than managing investments available to retail investors, which are not allowed to cut the manager in on the profits. And the really disgusting part of all this, quite frankly, is that a lot of these guys wish that they could offer their services to hardworking people instead of just rich guys who are not accredited investors. But in order to get a share of the profits, and who could blame them for wanting a share of the profits if they have these extraordinary market-beating skills? Well, the law says that only the wealthy are allowed to invest with them.
That's incredible. 71.8% average returns over a 20-year period is truly mind-boggling. Now, if you can gain access to an opportunity like that, it seems to me like you're just you'd be crazy not to jump on that.
Well, it's true. You would be absolutely crazy not to jump on it. The thing is that most people don't have that opportunity, including rich guys. You can't gain that access. So first of all, in its heyday, Medallion Fund had a 5-44 fee structure. And yes, that really means what it sounds like. You paid a 5% fee. That's 5% of your total account size. You pay them a fee of that amount just for the privilege of being in their fund. So back in the heyday of the fund, treasury bonds were returning about 5%. It's basically the same number, but in the other direction, you pay them. On top of that, they keep almost half the profits. Now, with that staggering fee structure, that 71.8% average annual gross return translates into a net return after you pay fees of only 34% per year. Now, of course, you'd still be crazy not to jump at the chance to invest because 34% annualized net return after fees adds up pretty darn fast. That's a fantastic investment return. But guess what? They had a $25 million minimum investment. And on top of that, you literally had to be very well connected on Wall Street just to get in. These days, Renaissance is still running money, but only for former partners in the firm. They got so rich running Medallion for other investors that the only way they can deal with the capacity-limited aspect of their trading strategy is not to allow anyone other than the founders of the company to invest in what they have today as a fund. That same story rings true for a lot of the legendary names in the hedge fund business. George Soros, Stan Druckenmiller, Jim Rogers. These are all guys who made a killing running hedge funds. But these days, they just run their own money because they're so rich that they don't need the hassle of having customers. Remember, the strategies that truly outperform the market are almost always capacity limited. That means the best of the best start out by being very exclusive about who they take money from. Then the really talented managers get filthy rich, quite frankly, and they close their funds to outside money and just run their own fortunes. Now, if you can figure out who one of these up-and-coming winners is before they get famous, you can get in on the ground floor. But by the time it's clear that they're going to become a rock star, it's too late for anyone but billionaires to get in on their funds.
Wow, and government regulations make sure guys like me never get the chance to invest with any of these guys, period. You know, I'm so grateful for the protection I'm afforded by regulators. Now, let's move down a rung on the proverbial ladder from the rock stars like Soros and Druckenmiller and Rogers. There are lots of really impressive guys still running funds that take outside money. Ray Dalio, Jeff Gundluck, David Tepper, Kyle Bass, Carl Icahn, and his best pal, Bill Ackman. They all come to mind. I mean, these are all fund managers that are running funds that are still open to outside investors. Now, what does it take to invest with these guys?
It depends. To invest directly in funds managed by big name talent like the guys you just mentioned, in my opinion, you need $100 million in personal net worth in order to play in that club. Most of those funds are going to have $5 million minimum investment thresholds, if not higher. And even then, you may still need an introduction in order to get into those funds. There are two alternative ways, however, to play with the big boys in the hedge fund space. And both of them are available to people with more modest wealth, let's say $25 million or so in personal net worth. The first of those two ways to get in is called a feeder fund. The idea is the Rockstar Manager hedge fund only has 500 slots for qualified purchasers because it's organized as a 3C7 fund, as we discussed in part three. So somebody else not connected with the Rockstar Manager comes along and creates another fund under the 3C1 exemption. And that's known as a feeder fund. Its sole purpose is just take money from investors and turn around and invest that money in the 3C7 fund that's being run by the Rockstar Manager. Since it's a 3C1 fund, any accredited investor can invest in it. You don't have to be a qualified purchaser. And the minimums are much lower, maybe $1 million instead of $5 million. The principle of operation of the feeder fund is that it only takes up one slot in the Rockstar managed fund, but it has 100 slots to sell to smaller accredited investors who couldn't ante up for a slot of their own in the main fund. The Rockstar Manager is not allowed to set up his own feeder fund. There's a regulation against that. But an arm's length third party is allowed to do it. The thing is, though, that arm's-length third-party guy, he's going to want to get paid for his efforts. So now you're paying the already generous fee structure of the Rockstar Fund, and then you're paying another layer of fees on top of that to the firm that sets up the feeder fund. Think of it like paying a premium for concert tickets to a scalper because he had the connections to get the good tickets before they sold out and you didn't. The other way in is through a fund of funds that is designed specifically to make several different Rockstar-managed funds accessible all at once to smaller investors. So it's the same idea as a feeder fund, but it's to multiple different funds. They're still going to charge an extra layer of fees, and they're still going to have a significant minimum investment. But what's most important to understand is you're going to be investing in a basket of several different funds. Some of them are going to be the ones that you wanted so badly to get into, but you weren't able to. Other ones, though, maybe you weren't so interested in. So the key there is finding a fund of funds that invests in exactly the basket of Rockstar manager funds that you personally want to get into.
Okay, so to summarize, if you're a really big fish, let's say more than $100 million in personal net worth, you can invest directly with managers who are indisputably in what you would call group one. But if you're not, you have to learn how to look for the up-and-comers who aren't as well known and develop the skill to separate them from the con men. So, Eric, what's your advice on how to develop that specific skill?
I think it all starts with being willing to invest the time and energy into learning all about this stuff yourself. Listening to a lot of hedge fund pitches and developing the ability to recognize who actually has something unique on offer versus who's just blowing smoke. The con men in this game are pretty good at their game. Unless you're willing to invest some time and energy learning about this stuff, they'll see you coming and take you to the cleaners. My other comment is to be careful of how you do your own shopping. One guy that I met in New York, for example, told me his strategy was just to go to one of the online hedge fund databases and sort all of the funds according to which one has the highest performance. Now, sure enough, taking that approach, he was able to find several funds that had triple-digit returns, more than 100% a year, for all of their 2 or 3 year history. Then he was shocked when one of the funds he invested in turned out to be a fraud. Now, whose fault was that? So if anything, triple-digit returns should be a caution flag. Obviously, those kind of returns are fantastic if you can get them. But if you can, insist on understanding how they were achieved. If the guy was smart enough to see the housing crisis coming and bought credit default swaps like the hedge fund managers that were depicted in the film The Big Short, well, great. That's a credible explanation for those huge returns, and it's a feather in the manager's cap that he was smart enough to see that one coming. But searching for funds that deliver incredible returns without any explanation for where those extraordinary performance numbers are coming from, that's asking for trouble.
Yeah, sounds suspect. Now, Eric, I want to go back to the subject of hedge fund strategies. You described how the strategy that A.W. Jones introduced in 1949, where the long portfolio is hedged by a short portfolio, is now known as a long-short equity strategy. Well, what are some of the other common hedge fund strategies out there?
Wow, there's a lot of them. I'm just going to have to give you a few examples of what comes to mind. Global macro is a strategy that's based on understanding the global macroeconomic system and looking for predictable outcomes in currency pairs, various global equity and fixed income markets, and so forth. So a global macro fund can trade more different instruments than most other strategies, and their mandate is generally allowing them considerable breadth and basically figuring out the world and figuring out what trades to put on in order to benefit from things that they can observe. So, for example, a global macro manager might develop an opinion that the result of an election in France will dramatically change the probability of whether or not more countries leave the European Union. So, based on that view, they might put a trade on expecting the euro to depreciate or appreciate against other currencies, or they might expect one stock market to outperform other stock markets in Europe. So that's one strategy. Another one that comes to mind, totally different category, would be something called merger arbitrage. Merger arbitrage is a strategy in which basically the idea is that when one public company acquires another company, as soon as that news is made public, the stock of the company being acquired goes up, and the stock of the acquiring company often takes a small hit to the downside. Now, these mergers always require government approval, and if that approval is denied, the price trend will reverse abruptly. So a merger arb fund is one where the manager tries to gather as much intelligence information as possible so as to be able to predict what companies might acquire other companies, and also to have a view view on whether regulators are going to kill the deal or not. They then try to position themselves just ahead of when they think that news will become public so that they can capture the sudden moves that occur in stock prices when the news comes out. Totally in another category completely is something called activist funds. Carl Icahn is a big name in that field. Activist funds look for public companies with corrupt or incompetent management. They then acquire a big enough stake to gain one or more seats on the board of directors, and they basically threaten the company's existing management to either shape up or be fired. The investment thesis is if they can force the reform of a corrupt or incompetent management, the value of the stock that they bought in order to gain control of the company to be able to make those threats will go up dramatically. Now, Carl Icahn is accused by many of being, you know, a corporate raider, utterly heartless and greedy. But if you hear Carl's side of the story, he's basically looking for companies that have corrupt or incompetent management. And he thinks of himself as the good guy, as a sort of a vigilante who forces justice upon corrupt and incompetent managers for the benefit of all shareholders. Now, one thing's for sure is Carl knows how to play hardball with entrenched management. So, you know, I guess it depends on your perspective. But that strategy is called activist hedge funds. Total other strategy, statistical arbitrage, often just called stat arb. That's a fund that uses computer models to predict statistically likely outcomes in the stock market. So, for example, the traditional stat arb strategy is where the computers are programmed to scan the price history of all stocks in existence and look for something called correlation pairs. In other words, you might learn from price history that you can predict that if Intel stock moves in a big way, Microsoft stock is likely to move in the same direction in sympathy. Well, what their computers do is analyze and identify thousands of these correlation pairs, and then they scan market price feeds in real time, looking for one but not both of the stocks in a correlated pair to make a big move. When that happens, they assume a position in the other stock in that correlated pair. When it follows suit, they cash in, they make their profit, and they move on. So they're essentially using computers to just follow predictable patterns in how different stocks move in sympathy to others. These days, that simple correlation pair strategy has been pretty much worn out, and the stat arb funds that are successful use much more sophisticated computer models to predict more complex interactions and trends that occur in markets. Still another fund, socially responsible funds, are just funds that are managed not so much trying to make an outsized return, but trying to be do-gooders. They're very popular with left-leaning family offices and wealthy individuals who want to do good in the world and invest in something that that has some positive benefit to society. They're usually mandated to try to match the S&P 500 rather than trying to beat it. And the way that they outperform is to invest in socially worthy causes. Quant funds, we talked about Jim Simons and Medallion Fund earlier. That's basically what that strategy is about. There are also just myriad different specialized funds for different purposes. Believe it or not, one that's really hot right now is marijuana funds. The legalization of marijuana creates opportunities. Potable water is another one that there are funds dedicated to. A lot of people think there's going to be a major world drinking water crisis in the next 20 years. There are funds that focus just on that.
Yeah, sounds like the marijuana funds are on fire, Eric. Any others you care to mention?
Well, finally, I want to discuss one that nobody likes to talk about. Quite frankly, if you want to know what investment strategy is most likely to consistently produce outsized returns that beat the market, drum roll please, the answer is breaking the law, illegal insider trading. The industry doesn't like to admit it, but it's very well known that some of the most profitable hedge funds of yesteryear derived their outsized returns almost entirely from illegal insider trading. I think it's similar to the way that some morally corrupt people would never commit a murder themselves because it would violate their morals and religious beliefs. But somehow that same guy has no problem hiring a hitman to do the dirty work for him to get rid of his enemy. So the analogy here is I think there's a plausible deniability function among some asset allocators where people who would never commit a crime themselves because they don't want to risk prosecution are happy to kind of look the other way and allocate capital to a fund when they know perfectly well that the only way the manager could possibly be producing those returns is if he's doing something illegal, but they, you know, pretend not to know about it. For many years, the SEC was very widely criticized as being too lax on enforcing insider trading in the hedge hedge fund industry. That's changed, though, in recent years. The very public case of Raj, or I can never say this guy's name.
Rajaratnam.
This is a guy who consistently produced 22% average annual returns for his investor. Did he have some brilliant insight to anything? No, he just knew a lot of people, and he was prosecuted and made an example of by the SEC. I think the SEC was trying to scare other people away from these illegal practices.
Okay, so let's say I'm an accredited investor and want to learn more about investing in hedge funds myself, hopefully not the ones run by pretenders. How would I go about it?
Well, my strongest advice is to learn as much as you can personally about hedge funds before you invest in anything. We talked in part two about organizations like the Institute for Private Investors, or IPI. That's an ideal place to learn more about investing in hedge funds and other alternative investments. It's also an opportunity to network with more experienced private investors who have invested in alternatives before and kind of know the ropes, so to speak. My next advice is follow first, invest later. Remember from part three that if you are accredited, you can reach out to almost any hedge fund with a one-line email saying, I am an accredited investor. Please send me information about your fund and add me to your monthly tear sheet distribution. So to be sure, you can expect them, if you do that, to want to invite you to a so-called pitch meeting where they'll try to sell you on investing in their fund right away tomorrow. But you can just politely decline and say that you would like to follow their tear sheet for a few months and get a sense of what they do. And they're used to that. Most funds have 10 times more people receiving their tear sheets each month than are actually invested in the fund. As I described in part three, it's like getting a free subscription to that fund manager's personal one-page newsletter where he tells you what's on his mind each month. And you can also follow the news and see if he's proven right or wrong as he makes predictions. Some funds even describe their trade positions in their tear sheets. The vast majority of hedge funds also have something called a pitch book, which is essentially their sales presentation for the fund. The pitch book will often lay out their high-level investing principles and describe their strategy in fairly concise detail. So getting your hands on a fund's pitch book might be a little bit harder than subscribing to their monthly tear sheet. Some funds will be happy to send you a copy of their pitch book as a PDF that they just email to you for your own private review as soon as you represent yourself to them as being an accredited investor. But other funds are going to view the contents of their pitch book as proprietary, and they want to keep it out of the hands of their competitors. In those cases, they might tell you that in order to see the pitch book, you have to agree to attend an in-person pitch meeting, which is basically a sales call where they try to sell you on investing in the fund. Most funds that are willing to send you their pitch book will ask you to be qualified first. They want to make sure you're a bona fide investor, not a competitor. And of course, they're trying to size you up and see how interested you are in investing with them, which you have to expect from a salesperson who's just doing their job. But they're quite used to investors telling them, hey, don't call me for a follow-up. I will call you if I'm interested in investing with you. For now, I just want you to send me your information and that's it. And they'll generally respect your wishes if you say that. There are fund databases that you can use to search for hedge funds, as well as for other alternative investment funds online. Most of them will give you a free trial subscription if you represent yourself as being an accredited investor. But then after you've done 10 searches or so, they'll tell you that they want money in order to continue your subscription. And that money is a worthwhile expense to pay for if you're serious about investing in hedge funds and other alternatives. These databases all have the performance history of every single fund from inception to date, as well as a whole bunch of other searchable statistics about these funds. The industry would like you to believe that the way you should find these things is to put blind faith in middlemen called capital introduction brokers who will do the due diligence work for you in advance and only introduce you to the funds that are worthy of your consideration. As I mentioned earlier, these are the people who made Bernie Madoff what he was. I'm sure that there are good ones out there, and their services, I'm sure, are very valuable. But frankly, I've met more sleazeballs than gentlemen in that business, and I'd rather do my own research.
Okay, that's as much time as we have for hedge funds. Let's move on to commodity trading advisors and managed commodity futures pools. What are these investment vehicles all about, Eric?
To make sense of that question, we have to first take a step back and understand the big picture of commodity futures contracts and the role that they play in the overall global financial system. In the beginning, many years ago, it was much more straightforward. From a legal perspective, stocks and bonds are collectively known as securities, and they're regulated by the Securities Exchange Commission, or SEC. Commodities, on the other hand, such as copper, wheat, sugar, cocoa, and so forth, are traded with something called a commodity futures contract. The buyer of a commodity futures contract is obligated to buy a fixed quantity of some commodity at some future date at a price that's set when the futures contract is purchased. The reason the future date was so important is that it allowed traders to speculate on the price of commodities without having to take physical delivery of those commodities. So, for example, if you bought 1 million bushels of soybeans on the commodity futures market, you didn't need a silo to store all those soybeans in. You held the contract until you were ready to close out your trade. Then you sold the contract. You might profit or you might lose, but one way or the other, the commodity futures contract gave traders a way to own a future interest in a commodity without needing a place to physically store that commodity. These days, the boundaries between securities markets and commodity futures markets have blurred considerably because the various financial market exchanges are competing with one another. Commodity futures contracts have some very favorable trading attributes, but originally they were just for commodities, not for securities. All that changed about 20 years ago. These days, there are commodity futures contracts for what we traditionally think of as commodities, such as crude oil, copper, soybeans, and so forth. But these days, we also have futures contracts for the S&P 500 stock index or 10-year U.S. Treasury bonds. So effectively, commodities futures contracts can now be used to trade almost anything, including securities. The New York Stock Exchange is only open for 6.5 hours per business day from 9:30 a.m. to 4 p.m. New York time. But S&P 500 stock index futures contracts trade 23 hours per day. That means that if some big news event happens at 2 a.m., let's say there's an earthquake or something, the trader who uses futures contracts to trade the S&P 500 can buy or sell instantly in reaction to the news, whereas the trader who directly trades on the stock exchange will have to wait for regular trading hours when the exchange is open. Securities markets are regulated by the SEC, but commodity futures markets are regulated by the Commodity Futures Trading Commission under a totally different set of rules. And one of those rules says that regular hedge funds cannot invest more than 5% of their assets under management in commodity futures. In order to put more than 5% of your money toward commodity futures contract performance bonds, you have to be separately licensed by the CFTC as a commodity pool operator, or CPO. You also have to be registered with the National Futures Association, or NFA, the industry's self-regulatory agency. Now let's go back to your original question, which is, what are commodity trading advisors and managed commodity pools? The shorter answer is, these are the legal names for investment vehicles that are regulated by the CFTC, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, and theoretically have to do with trading commodities as opposed to securities. But again, that has become a very blurry line. Some of these so-called commodity funds trade nothing but stock index futures.
Got it. Commodity trading advisors and managed commodity pools are for trading commodities, not securities. Except that the so-called commodities that they are trading may very well be securities that are traded through a different mechanism. But what is the difference between a commodity trading advisor, or CTA, and a commodity pool operator, or CPO, and not to be confused with C3PO?
It does get pretty confusing. Think of a CTA, a commodity trading advisor, as the commodity trading equivalent of what we used to call a full-service stockbroker. The stockbroker wanted to buy and sell stocks for you. That's how he made his commission. And if you knew what stock you wanted to buy or sell, he'd be happy to put that trade on for you in your account. If you weren't sure what you wanted to buy or sell, he was also happy to recommend stocks to buy based on research that his firm was doing on your behalf, supposedly. The commodity trading advisor is exactly the same thing for commodities. So it's not a fund that you invest in like a hedge fund. You have your own personal commodity account, just like you might have a brokerage account. The CTA will place orders on your instructions if you want them to, but more often than not, the CTA is offering some kind of computerized trend following system where they're going to recommend trades following some systemic model that trades your account automatically, and supposedly they will tell you that their trading system has produced phenomenal returns in the past. So if the CTA is the commodity futures equivalent of a full-service brokerage account, an individual account, then a managed commodity pool is the commodity equivalent of a hedge fund. In the commodity pool, you invest money to purchase an interest in the fund. Then the fund manager invests your money, as well as other investors' money, in commodity futures contracts. Back in the old days, that really meant investing in commodities: copper, corn, wheat, soybeans, pork bellies, crude oil, sugar, cocoa, and so forth. These days, it could be anything. One managed commodity pool might truly be investing in conventional commodities, but another might be using commodity futures contracts to invest in stock index futures, interest rate futures, and other financial instruments that have nothing to do with commodities.
So which one is an accredited investor more likely to be interested in, a CTA or a CPO?
Well, it could be either. Now, stockbrokers and investment advisors are not allowed to charge their clients a percentage of the profits, and that means the most talented people are not going to be drawn to that job because they want to be cut in on the profits. The rules are different in the commodity world. The CTA is allowed to charge his client a percentage of the profits. So there are attractive managers, you know, talented people or talented CTAs that use very sophisticated computer programs that deliver interesting products to accredited investors, both CTA or CPO. The CPO is the one that is equivalent to a hedge fund. And there's an important restriction to understand, though, which is CTAs deal only in commodities. But an investment fund can be something known as a hybrid fund, which means that it invests in both commodity futures and securities. This is accomplished by being registered as a commodity pool operator, but also having a mandate to trade securities in the same fund.
Well, let's focus on managed commodity pools and hybrid funds, since that seems like the commodity rules cousin of a hedge fund. Now, who invests in these funds and why? What are their advantages and disadvantages over conventional hedge funds?
Managed futures is really hot right now. If you go to a family office conference, you will find salesmen coming out of the woodwork to tell you all about how managed futures are the hottest thing going. You really need to allocate some of your portfolio to managed futures, because managed futures is a red-hot asset class that is the trendy thing to do, or at least that's what they want you to believe. Look, as a guy who manages one of these hybrid funds myself, I am here to tell you that's the biggest bunch of bullshit that I ever heard. The salesmen who are trying to push managed futures as the hot new asset class that you just have to be invested in are full of crap. Now, to call a commodity futures contract an asset class is disingenuous at best, so far as I'm concerned. So consider, for example, one guy with a managed futures fund offering might be running a fund that uses trend following software to trade in and out of both long and short speculative positions in conventional commodity contracts such as base metals, energy, natural gas, crude oil, soft commodities, grains, sugar, cocoa, and so forth. That strategy is all about making a buck by following trends using computers, whether they be up or down. Now take another example of a different guy who's maybe a big fan of Jim Rogers and thinks that agricultural commodities are headed to the moon in the next 20 years. So he's running a long-only commodity fund that seeks to benefit from a secular increase in agricultural commodity prices as food becomes a much larger percentage of GDP in coming decades, as some people are predicting. That's a totally, completely different strategy from the trend-following guy. Now consider someone like myself running a macro strategy, but registered as a CPO in order to be able to trade commodity futures. That investment thesis is all about trying to figure out geopolitical and financial trends on a global scale and make bets on currency exchange rates, interest rates, and so forth. The manager knows that commodity futures contracts provide an excellent access to currency pairs, to global stock indices, to bond markets around the world. So he registers as a commodity pool operator in addition to trading securities so that he'll be able to exceed that 5% limit on assets that can be committed to commodity futures contract margin requirements. Now, those are three totally radically different investment strategies. They're not in the same asset class. They will perform completely differently under different economic circumstances. So to lump them together just because they all share in common the fondness of a particular contractual instrument, the commodity futures contract, and to pretend that that makes managed futures an asset class in the sense of portfolio construction theory, where you're trying to compose a portfolio of decorrelated asset classes, that's utterly ridiculous.
So in other words, you're saying that a managed commodity pool is just a name for a legal structure needed if the fund manager wants to be able to trade more than 5% of assets in commodity futures contracts, and that there could be any number of different reasons for wanting to be able to do that.
Exactly. You got it precisely correct. And there's absolutely nothing that you can conclude about the nature of the investments being made or their likely performance in different economic scenarios just solely from the fact that a fund is organized under commodity pool rules, other than the fact that the manager wanted the flexibility to trade commodity futures.
Sounds to me like a hybrid fund affords the most versatility and flexibility to the manager, since it gives him the discretion to invest in securities or commodities as market conditions warrant. Now, if that's true, I think most sophisticated fund managers would set up a hybrid structure just to keep as many options open as possible.
Well, funny you say that. I used to think exactly the same thing until I went through this process myself. Ironically, the reason that hybrid funds are not much more popular than they are, because everything you just said is exactly true. It gives the manager ultimate flexibility in being able to invest in anything. So it's a fantastic way to prosecute a macro strategy where you want to keep your options open. But ironically, the reason that these funds are not much more popular than they are has everything to do with regulations on the marketing side of this. A lot of hedge funds and managed futures funds are sold through these middlemen known as capital introduction brokers. But the thing is, the license needed to sell a commodity pool is different from the license needed to sell a hedge fund. So in order to sell a hybrid fund, the cap intro broker has to have both licenses, and very few of them have both licenses. So as a result, a lot of fund managers who intend to rely on cap intro brokers for marketing their fund are generally going to choose one or the other. Either they go in the hedge fund direction and they just live with the 5% limitation, or they go in the other direction and run a managed commodity futures fund only. And, you know, it sounds like that limits them, but actually you can trade just about anything through commodity futures contracts these days. So, you know, it really does give you a lot of flexibility. But the reason that they don't do hybrid funds is because the guy who's selling it, the middleman, would have to have two licenses. For the managed futures guy, though, that wants to run a macro strategy, you know, you want to be long the Nikkei stock index, there's a commodity futures contract for that. You want to hedge exposure to your foreign exchange risk in that trade by having also a position on the dollar-yen cross, there's a commodity futures contract for that. You want to be short German bunds, there's a commodity futures contract for that. So from a macro strategy standpoint, you can do a lot of things with a fund that is exclusively managed futures. But the fact that it's managed futures doesn't tell you anything about what asset class it really is. You have to find out what the investment strategy actually is based on.
Great. So CTAs and CPOs make a lot more sense now. So let's move on to funds of funds. What are they and what's the rationale for investing in them?
For starters, the answer to that question is a matter of great contention and disagreement in accredited investor circles. Before getting into that controversy, let's just start with some basic definitions, though. A fund of funds is simply an investment fund that invests in other investment funds. So the fund of funds manager is not directly making trades in financial markets. His function as the manager is to research the performance of other fund managers, conduct due diligence on them, and compose a balanced portfolio of investments in several underlying funds. But this manager wants to be paid for his time too. So he's going to charge a fee structure, usually both a management fee and a performance fee, on top of the fees that are being charged by the underlying funds. So back to the controversy. Is what I just described a brilliant way to hire a really talented expert to help you invest in hedge funds? So the expert picks the best funds to create a diversified hedge fund portfolio for you. You just invest in his fund of funds. Or is this just a scam designed to add yet another layer of fees onto what the accredited investor is already paying for the privilege of being in those underlying managed funds?
Well, Eric, don't leave us hanging.
Okay. Well, I think the answer is both. To elaborate on that, let's consider the possible motivations of the hypothetical fund-to-funds manager. One possibility might be the guy who started out as an accredited private investor himself. He started investing in hedge funds. Maybe he even got burned once or twice. But eventually, he got really good at it. He figured out that hedge fund due diligence is more of an art than a science, and he eventually learned to spot the winners and losers consistently. He began to really see phenomenal performance performance in his own portfolio of hedge fund investments as a private investor. Soon, the word of his success got out to other accredited private investors, and all of his accredited investor friends were constantly hitting him up for advice. What fund should I invest in? What's your favorite fund? Eventually, he realized that his skill in picking managers was just as valuable as a service as the returns that he was making on his own money. So in response to the sea of people that were hitting him up because he was so successful as a hedge fund investor himself, he goes and launches his own fund of funds. That allows his friends and family and colleagues and peers to invest alongside him and to give himself access to bigger funds with rock star managers. Because maybe, let's say this guy had $25 million of his own money, that's not enough to play with the big boys. But if he gets another $100 million of his friend's money, now that $125 million in aggregate, he can invest in just about anything. There most assuredly are guys with exactly that backstory. In fact, I've met a couple of them. In some cases, they may even be so good-hearted as to take the approach of using the asset size advantage that they gain from running a fund as opposed to just their own money, and use that advantage to negotiate fee discounts with the funds they invest in, for the benefit of everyone in their fund. I met one guy in New York who claimed that his fund of funds, which had a 1 in 15 fee structure, was effectively free because the fee discounts that he had negotiated with the underlying funds balanced out, and the 1 in 15 that he was charging his clients, effectively you didn't pay anything extra than what you would have paid in investing directly in the underlying funds. So if that was the, you used the C-3PO Star Wars example, if that was the light side of the force, let's shift gears and visit with Darth Vader now. Consider the other guy who maybe heard about this whole hedge fund manager lifestyle and wants in on it. The only problem is he has no skill or talent. Maybe he's the used car salesman guy who heard how much money hedge fund managers make and he wants a piece of the pie. So he's looking for a way in, but he doesn't have the ability to launch a hedge fund because he doesn't have the talent to make the trades. So instead, he launches a fund of funds. He leverages his prior career experience as a used car salesman, and he hits the country clubs and yacht clubs where he puts on an act designed to present himself in this image of extraordinary success, playing the old trick of pretending that he only allows a few very select clients into his very exclusive fund. So the rich folks at the country club or the yacht club basically need to kiss up to him and beg if they want in on it. And believe me, I've met this guy, and so has everyone else in the business. He expects to be wined and dined by the fund managers, because unlike the typical accredited investor who can only come in at $500,000, say, he's running a fund, so he can come in at $5 million with his initial investment. And if you're a small hedge fund manager, that $5 million investment is something you really want. Or so he'd like you to believe he's able to do that. He may even demand that fund managers pay him a kickback of the fees that he pays them. The argument that he makes is, he says, look, you've got other investors that are coming to you through capital introduction brokers that are getting a share of the fees that are produced. I'm my own capital introduction broker, so I'm going to come with other people's money, my fund of funds. I'll invest that in your hedge fund, and you, Mr. Hedge Fund Manager, need to pay me a personal kickback, 20% of the fees you pay me personally of the fees that my clients are indirectly paying to you. As a result of that, all ethical and responsible fund managers are going to walk away and tell that guy to take a hike. The desperate few who really badly need to raise assets in order to stay in business are going to cave and take that guy up on his terms. The result is that his fund of funds is actually a cesspool of toxic assets and incompetent management, because that's who he was able to assemble on the terms that he wanted. So my point is this: both of these guys exist in the fund of funds world. Unfortunately, the second guy is probably more common. If you can figure out how the first guy is, the guy who was really successful investing his own money in hedge funds and ended up launching a fund of funds to allow others to invest alongside of him, that's the guy that you probably would seriously want to consider investing with. The guy that only has $500,000 in net worth, you don't want to invest in that guy's fund of funds, and unfortunately, he's going to lie about it and pretend to have more invested than he really does.
So the basic trade-off in considering a fund of funds is that what you're buying for those extra fees is the talent of a world-class hedge fund investor, not hedge fund manager. Put another way, they have to be good enough at what they do so as to be sufficiently better at it than you would be yourself, so as to justify the extra layer of fees. Is that the gist of it?
Yes and no. In the case of fund of funds that exist for the purpose of trying to find the best hedge funds to invest in, the whole scenario that we just talked about a minute ago, you got it exactly right. You hit the nail on the head. But there's another scenario we should mention, which is another fund of funds strategy, is the one that is all about gaining access to those rock star managers that were out of reach, even to people with $50 million of net worth. So consider a hypothetical accredited individual investor with a lot of knowledge and experience in hedge fund investing, but he's only got $25 million in personal net worth, and he wants to invest with Jeff Gundlach and Kyle Bass and Ray Dalio and all of these other big names. Believe it or not, his $25 million is nowhere close to big enough to invest in a diversified basket of hedge funds with rock star managers like Carl Icahn, Jeff Gundlach, Ray Dalio, Kyle Bass, and so forth. So what he does is to launch a fund of funds targeting other accredited investors like himself, and he says to his accredited peers, look, none of us are big enough to directly step up to those $5 million plus in minimum investment thresholds, upwards of $25 million in some cases, in order to invest with the really serious rock star managers. But if we pool our resources together into a $250 million fund of funds, we'll be able to invest with anybody we want. So there's a special class of fund of funds that's entirely about gaining access to the biggest and brightest managers that would be out of reach to most individual investors, even if they have $20 to $50 million in personal net worth.
It still blows my mind that these huge investment minimums that seem to have so many far-reaching implications all derive from regulatory requirements, which, so far as I can tell from everything we've talked about, don't actually serve to protect the public from anything in particular.
Your tax dollars at work, my friend.
Well, I'm afraid we're out of time once again. Eric, you originally conceived this as a four-part series. Then we added part 3A to incorporate your angel investing interview with David Rose. So now it's a five-part series. But frankly, by the time we were done, it was a struggle to keep parts 3 and 4 to a recordable size, and we were forced to leave out some content we hoped to cover. So where do we go from here? Are we going to do Accredited Investor Academy parts 5, 6, and 7 next?
To be honest, I'm not sure, Aaron. It's going to depend on the reaction we get now that the first version of the series is finally finished and published. What we realized in outlining these last two parts is we had to leave a huge amount out due to time constraints. We kept editing the script down. The table of contents had to keep, you know, being reduced to fit it into an hour episode, and both of them went over an hour. So we could easily do another full hour on hedge fund due diligence reviews alone. I've talked about how I'm not a big fan of capital introduction brokers, but we really didn't go into much detail on how to go about doing the research yourself to find the best alternative investment managers. We didn't talk about the different databases that are available on the internet, for example. Another huge area that we didn't talk about at all is portfolio construction. How do you design a personal investment portfolio that includes alternative investments? How much do you allocate to private equity versus hedge funds? How do you find decorrelated asset classes even within the hedge fund and private equity and venture capital investments that you're making in order to design an optimal portfolio? We could do hours on that subject alone. And then there are completely tangential aspects of this that are of interest to accredited investors. For example, I personally am a strong believer that high net worth individuals and families should have at least 10% of their assets in physical precious metals, not ETFs like GLD, but allocated physical metal stored offshore in a jurisdiction other than the one that you reside in and are taxed in for the sake of disaster diversification. So somewhere in the world, you've got assets no matter what happens to the global financial system in the next 25 years. Now, that's a whole market unto itself, and understanding the storage options, the legal jurisdictions, how to negotiate the storage fees, that could be several shows unto itself. My motivation for doing this series in the first place was just that I never had access to any of this information when I was a newly accredited investor in the late 90s. And frankly, that cost me dearly. I got burned badly by the con men on Wall Street. So sharing what I've learned in hopes it saves someone else from being bitten by the sharks on Wall Street is personally gratifying to me. But, you know, where do we start? Where do we go? This could be much bigger. So I don't know if we'll ever do more than this basic four-part series, which, of course, as you said, with Part 3A is now a five-part series. So stay tuned. Listen to the Macro Voices podcast each week, which you can subscribe to on iTunes, and we'll let you know if we decide to add anything more to the series.
And with that, we are not only out of time, but over time. So that concludes part four of our Accredited Investor Academy, which for now is the final episode. All five episodes are available free of charge on the Accredited Investor Academy page at www.macrovoices.com/AIA. For Eric Townsend, I'm Aaron Chan, wishing all of you the very best in your personal journey as an accredited private investor.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and host, Eric Townsend, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit macrovoices.com.